This is Greyhound Nation, Episode 3, recorded Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. An interview with Laird Morgan, co-founder of United Greyhound Racing. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for Greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Hello and welcome to Greyhound Nation. I'm Michael Burns. And now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, everybody. Glad to have you. And we have a great guest today in Laird Morgan, co-founder of United Greyhound Racing. I've known Laird almost exclusively through our Greyhound forums on Facebook, but we have some similar ideas about Greyhound racing and the future of Greyhound racing here in the United States. So we thought he'd make an interesting guest for our listeners. Laird, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm glad to be here and certainly appreciate what you're doing for the Greyhound Nation.
So when you when I asked you to appear on the podcast, I told you it would be kind of like a friendly deposition. So we'll try to keep it not too unstructured. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about where you live and what you do for a living.
I live in Richardson, Texas, and I'm a lawyer, and I mostly represent family-owned businesses and medical practices and doing the transaction work. I've spent a lot of time in insurance litigation before that, and so that's my background, and that's my professional interest there.
When did you become interested in greyhounds and greyhound racing?
As I told you, that was 2007. My wife had a cow dog at the time. It was not doing well, and she was saying that she wanted her next dog to be a greyhound like a coworker had. And I asked her what I thought, and I said, fine, why a greyhound? And she said, well, after a while, people start to look like their dogs, and I want to be skinny. And I went along with that. I told her, get whatever dog you want. And so we went through the process of trying to learn about greyhounds, and went to her friend, and that friend introduced me to Ed Gardner, who's well known in the greyhound world and the proprietor of Health Guard, a leading supplement for greyhounds and for horses. And met Ed, and we ended up with adopting a greyhound from a Texas track that was owned and raced for Joy Burke. And in learning about the greyhounds on the internet, I learned about coursing and club racing. I knew nothing at the time, and it's been an adventure. The people, we decided to try club racing, and we were welcomed by Gaze Hounds in Texas, and went out and schooled her there, and it was just an amazing, amazing experience. And from that point on, I've been in the greyhound world.
So this was a somewhat unusual greyhound adoption in that you adopted directly from a racing kennel. Do I understand that right? Not through a greyhound adoption group.
Correct. I've supported the greyhound adoption groups, two in North Texas. They would do great work, but in this situation, just because my wife's friend, her husband was a friend of Ed Gardner's, and she called Ed, and Ed said that he was going down to the golf track, and he would see, and brought back the dog that changed our world.
Excellent. Had you ever been to a greyhound race before that?
Ironically, I went to, after we decided to adopt a greyhound, before that time, all I knew about greyhound racing was the opening montage of Miami Vice. And then we went down to, I went to a seminar in Galveston, and we went to the Gulf Greyhound Park in Lamarck to actually see a race. And this was just a few weeks before we ended up adopting our hound. And what I remember was going in, and I'd read about it and all they offered. And we went to the dining area, and I asked the waitress, should we order from the menu or would she recommend the buffet? And she told me she couldn't recommend any of the food there. And I felt that was perhaps a foretelling of the future of Greyhound racing. But fortunately, the bar service was adequate, and we had a pleasant evening. And I still can, to this day, do not know how you can get from the dining area at golf down to the track if you actually want to watch a race close up. I don't know if it can be done.
Yeah, we've encountered that at a few other tracks, unfortunately. So we moved past, you adopted your Greyhound. You did a little club racing, which we also know as amateur racing in the U.S. And then how did you get interested in getting more involved in professional Greyhound racing?
In talking to Ed Gardner, and I went on to joined American Greyhound's message board, which was my leading source of information at the time. It was great because you had owners, you had kennels, you had trainers, you had gamblers. You had at the time it was every aspect of the Greyhound community, and they were for owning a retired racer that. You know, they were very helpful. People took the time to explain things to me and help me learn about Greyhound racing. And at Gardner, I ultimately expressed my interest in continuing and partnered with Ed and a couple of hounds he was raising. And that's how I entered the sport.
What was the name of your first pro racing Greyhound, the one you partnered with Ed on?
At the time, it would have been, well, it was an interest in several, and it would have been, I believe Turbo Percy was the first one of those that we had.
How did she do, or he do?
He that was kind of indicative. He didn't do well at all. In fact, I believe that one did not win a maiden race, and, we petted him out. That was my first foray, and we've had fortunately we've had some that have done better than that. But the first one to get to the track did not stay at the track.
Yeah, you kind of illustrated the old saying that how do you make a little money in Greyhound racing? You start with a lot of money.
I will just say that I used to be a very dedicated golfer, not necessarily a good golfer, but in between what I spent on club dues, trips, and equipment, because I always knew the golf equipment would improve my game no matter what I was spending, I knew that things would get better and I would enjoy this part or I'd be successful. I don't think I've ever had a year in Greyhound where I've lost more money or spent more money than I did in golf. So I've done all right. Yes, you do put in a good bit of money, but it really is such an incredible thing to watch a dog that has your name that you have an interest in to see how it does. And that's some of the great success we've had. The Ed at one point did name one of his hounds after me, Turbo Laird, who's now a very senior dog who lives with me, but I watched virtually all of his races, and that was that's really probably what triggered me into doing more and more with Ed and buying into his offer.
So Turbo Laird is there with you today, is that right?
Yes, he's in the next room. And
does he go by Turbo or Laird?
We go by TL for him. He gets the initial treatment. And that was interesting because we figured it'd be just too confusing because, you know, my wife's going to yell at me. We don't want to get the wrong one blamed. So he's TL and I'm Laird.
That's great. So let's fast forward a little bit. And then what was your next step in pro racing? Did you buy more interests in racers, or what was the next thing that you did?
The next step was you know, I went to annual meet. I joined, obviously, to be a part of this. I joined the TGA and the NGA to obviously own hounds. But my real next step was from the American Greyhounds message board, coming to know Eric Colts. And Eric called me about creating United Greyhound Racing. And because there was no single voice advocating greyhound racing from the owner perspective, small breeder perspective, or, you know, for the dedicated fan. And so we formed United Greyhound Racing. And that was what really opened the doors and got me into more aspects of the sport.
What was the original, what did you all see as the original mission of United Greyhound Racing?
The original mission was to engage more people in greyhound racing and get those who were somewhat involved more completely involved. And we worked to create interest. And among the things we've done was we've created the Mike Freno operates and runs our top 25 poll. And we create controversy, we create debates, and we have discussions. But every quarter, we have a top 25 dogs. And that's been popular for years. And then we also work with others who we try to give recognition to those that have been speaking out for the sport and create some awards. But our big draw to get the sport to another level has been creating the national championship race. And we had the national championship race run for several years at Daytona, and the last year, the year before last, at Naples. And our poll was the basis to provide the invitations to participate. First year was very difficult to get some dogs released from their track to get them to travel. And the next year we had much more interest. We also had more money from the sponsor to cover travel expenses, so that the owner was not really losing money for the time away from the track. It was making it closer to at least a break even to compete. I personally, if I had a dog that was invited for the national championship race, I wouldn't care about week worth of running at you know, most tracks. So, but we were able to get more money into the sport, and that's one of the things that we've done indirectly, is we've brought in probably close to $500,000 in money that would not have come into greyhound racing, but for what we got from our sponsors and from doing this, the promotions through Bet America and Watch and Wager. They were very good sponsors for a long time. And that's what made it possible. And we've done beyond that. One of my things that I was proud of, and United wasn't hugely successful, was I felt in talking to the adoption groups and dealing with the Greyhound Adoption League of Texas here and their meetings, people, when they adopt a greyhound, they don't really know about the greyhound's experience at the track. They frequently don't know the call name. They don't have the paperwork. So I created a heavy-duty envelope, which on the outside, the trainer and kennel contractor can write down details about the dog, the name, some of their personality aspects, note highlights of the career. Inside the envelope, the vaccinations and the NGA paperwork, and it would all stay together through the dog's trip from the track to the adoption, to the orientation, to the foster, and then on to the family that adopts the greyhound. And they could learn about it and have a contact number if they wanted to reach back and talk to the trainer at the track. And it's one of those things that people have really been pleased with, that have used it, but very few kennels requested or wanted to participate with us. But I got that way from the dogs that I was involved with that had been transported. Something always seemed to get lost during transportation of the hound. And that envelope kept everything together, at the least. And a lot of people, they loved reading about how the hound behaved at the track. So it was very popular, but Eric Colts, my co-founder, has several boxes of those envelopes in his garage in Illinois.
Are they still being used to some extent? I remember seeing them.
Yeah, well, they're still, I believe, well, they might still be used at Palm Beach at one kennel. But the other tracks where they were most readily accepted, those Florida tracks have already closed. So, yes, there may be one or two still going out with the hounds going into adoption. But basically, this was something that we never quite got the kennels to say, this is great. And it's because I think in a way there was no – the benefit was to everyone down the line after the dog left the kennel and not to the people in the kennel. But there were some trainers that just loved to write about their dogs. I mean, it was kind of fun to see some of the notes, and people would share the comments with us.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and it's a shame that it kind of, to the extent that it did, it died out a little bit, because you know that's one thing we always try to emphasize, that the racing people need to be involved in the adoption process to the extent of being available and at least having a contact information. Everybody knows they're busy and they work long, hard days, but that little bit of information could mean all the difference to an adopter, you know, having a positive experience with the racing end of the Greyhound's life.
I think that this, you're exactly on the point. And I think a lot of people have dark thoughts of the track just because the kennels are in a different world and it's not accessible, and we don't do enough to really, you know, bring the hounds into the forefront of where people would see them or engage with them. And the kennels have been the backside of the track has been, you know, average person's not even allowed back there. They're not allowed past an adoption kennel. But because it's such a secretive world, people frequently draw dark impressions of it. And this sort of thing was an opportunity to bridge that and provide communication between the person that has adopted the Greyhound and the people that really developed that Greyhound. And I know we could have done better with that.
Well, it takes two to tango, and you know, you can only do so much in terms of producing the physical envelope and the ability to do it. It has to be, the rubber meets the road is with the trainer, usually sometimes in conjunction with the adoption group they work with, to emphasize to the trainer, the kennel operator, the need to fill that out and get all the documents together and so forth. You hear that complaint with some regularity that the Greyhounds have come to us without shot records, or they're out there, they just haven't, somebody didn't take the time to get it all together and take 5 or 10 minutes to write a few notes, and it's too bad that it was a missed opportunity. So when you started United Greyhound Racing and you were starting the national championship race, how did you go about getting traction with the various tracks?
That's something of a challenge, because and this was something that Eric Colt shouldered. This, I mean, Eric called people, worked on people he knew to leverage his relationship with the kennels to try to build his relationship with the tracks. And you have to understand that there's a component here that Southland or it itself is not going to, they're going to want to run their own stakes race and their own events. And that's the track that has the highest paying, it's the highest paying track in the country and would attract the top hounds. And you really can't have a national championship race unless, and call it a national championship, if you don't have hounds from Southland and Wheeling, the top two tracks. So it was a question of how do we get the dogs from those tracks that are pretty well scheduled out with their own championship races. And then we look at tracks that are trying to build something or build a crowd or create a unique event. So we happen to be fortunate with Daytona. Daytona is a small track, a wonderful facility. The size and scale of the Daytona track is where Greyhound racing needs to be headed. And the track itself is very well maintained. I would like to see a bigger, wider first turn. But other than that, it's a really good facility. And it's owned by Delaware North, which also owns Wheeling and Southland. And getting the management of Daytona on board, which was looking for an event like this, they're able to use their influence within the Delaware North family to get the dogs released from Wheeling and Southland to make them available to come to Daytona for a national championship race. And there's enough of a relationship between the tracks in Florida that the Derby Lane, Jacksonville, and Palm Beach, the middle tier, the better Florida tracks, could release hounds. So we could get a field put together for a national championship race. And it was at Southland, it's one of those things with, you know, we have relationships, or Eric or I, but one of us will can reach out to racing secretaries and we get along with them. And we're able to talk about the selling this race. And we built the relationship with Southland to the point that we brought in Bet America sponsorship for the Bet America's People's Choice race, which became the qualifying race for Southland's dog to go to the national championship. And then one year we sponsored, along with Bet America, the Kings and Queens stakes race, which was a race of several of the finalists in the championship stakes at Southland. So it really is. We built backwards. We started the national championship, and then we had brought sponsorship to races at Southland, and that enabled us to get the top dogs from around the country to come to a national championship race.
Were the sponsors commercial companies, mostly tracks? What kind of sponsorships did you get?
The sponsorships was virtually all the sponsorship was either the first four was with Bet America and then Watch and Wager. And then we had other sponsorship from Greyhound. Ed Gardner's Health Guard was a sponsor. And we had small sponsorships from different Greyhound farms and owners that would contribute to it. But it was largely the track itself and Bet America, or in the last year, Watch and Wager, that contributed.
When was the last one run?
Year before last. It was Naples. That's the one I didn't go to. That was Mike Freno lives in that area, and he was he played a big role in getting that happening, and Eric Colts lined up Watch and Wager to sponsor. That we went with Watch and Wager because of the Bet America was taken over by its minority investor and Churchill Downs helped fund the creation of the Bet America parent, and they opted to take over the part of the company they didn't own, and they still have a Bet America brand name on ADW for Greyhound racing, but they're mainly. They're Twin Spires. That's their, you know, their horse racing, yeah. Their main gaming ADW platform.
What was the purse money for that last one? Was it winner take all, or did you divide it to the first three placements?
It would be a $50,000 total, but that's combined with there's a parent's money to cover the transportation, and then it's be about. I believe it's $20,000 for the winner, and that was all. Yeah, that would be for the winning.
What do you think the prospects are for another one?
Non-existent with the situation with Florida going away, Southland fading out. I don't think, I think Wheeling and Mardi Gras in West Virginia, they may have a few more years. Then you've got the Iowa, and that may be it. 2 weeks ago, Gulf said that they were giving up their license. They've said that before, but before when they gave it up, they told people to stay tuned. This time, they're not telling anyone to stay tuned. So right now, we have a handful of race dates in Texas. We have racing in Iowa. We have racing in West Virginia. We have racing coming to a conclusion in Arkansas. And the Florida will be ending, at least in its current structure. So it's national championship is just something that I don't see happening with where we are right now in racing.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Very disappointing. It was a great time.
Yeah. What's United Greyhounds Racing's mission now? Right now, what kind of operation are you doing?
We still maintain our ratings. We've still our other thing we haven't discussed is we have United Greyhound Racing Point Partners. We ran a nonprofit syndication of interest in greyhound racing, and we started out with North Shore Kennel at Southland. And we had a greyhound we got from Smith Greyhounds named Kiowa Oriole. And she was the opposite. She was a star for us. And I designed the program Point Partners as a syndication of revenue, not ownership, so that our subscribers would not have to become licensed. And we were syndicating revenue instead of ownership. So in Arkansas, West Virginia, Texas, and Florida, there was no license required. The definition of for requiring a license in Iowa, we put a hound to race in Iowa, but and Arkansas required that we secure a kennel license to run our syndication, and we rather than question that, we just went ahead and became licensed as a kennel in Arkansas. So, we brought in people that had never been involved with greyhound racing. We had them investing anywhere from a couple hundred dollars to $500 or $600 for their part of interest in this in Oriole. And we sent updates. They followed the race. We had basically we brought in people that became some of them went on to their own dogs, and it was just a great thing for greyhound racing. And then it was a lot of the tracks people complained about it. The kennels that weren't involved objected, and we ended up with after about the third or fourth dog, it wasn't worth really putting up with the complaints that we were facing. And that's one of those things that you go, why is greyhound racing fading? It's because we have a process that's hostile to innovation. We have a process that's hostile to new people joining in. And that's why we faded there.
Yeah, that's really a shame. I mean, that's a great innovation. I suspect that you had a number of the members of your syndicates were probably people that got started in greyhounds through greyhound adoption.
Yes. And we also, I mean, some people gave interest as gifts to people in the adoption community. It was there were some people that were just became involved because they were given a syndication share, and they became very dedicated. I mean, it was we would get emails about races, and we would make it a point to follow along with what they were doing. And we had those that supported it. We had, again, we had times. David Peck and Ed Gardner had both donated or made dogs available for us for very reasonable sums and created the opportunity that made this happen. And because they believe in the sport. And so, yeah, that was one of my frustrations, that we just did not have the support of the kennels over the long haul to keep doing it.
Did any of the syndicate members end up adopting the greyhounds that the syndicate owned?
Yeah, we had, in fact, I believe that they all went that way. We sadly had one tragedy of losing a hound in as a result of an injury in schooling, but other than that, the others did. We arranged either the person in the syndicate or the greyhound adoption group they were affiliated with took the hound.
Yeah. So let's move to your you began representing the Texas Greyhound Association. How did that come about?
Well, I've been a member, and I would advise, I would basically send emails on pending legislation or ask actions of the Texas Racing Commission. When I was first becoming active in the organization, we had an executive director who was also a lobbyist for interests related to golf. To me, it's sort of a conflict there, but I became more involved with following what's happening and just for the sake of it, advising certain members of the board who had an interest. Here's what's happening. Here's what could be affecting us. And then after a while, it was two of the president and two of the board members asked me to work for the TGA. And it's never been a big client. Certainly, I'm doing work that I have a passion for. And I was on the same page as far as where greyhound racing should be and the battles to be fought with the leadership that was in place when I was representing them. The people that brought me in as a counsel, they resigned, and I concluded my work during the time that, in fact, Ed Gardner, my original mentor, was brought in as president after a resignation of David Peck, and I wrapped up my work while Ed was serving as president.
So let's stick with Texas Greyhound Racing for a minute. Gulf, as you alluded, recently announced that they would not come back next year for the seasonal meeting. Where does that leave Texas Greyhound Racing?
Well, that's interesting. I think that as it stands now, it is a subject for the July 21st meeting of the Racing Commission, but there are race dates scheduled, 1 day to 5 day meets scheduled through 2021 at the Valley Race Park and at Corpus Christi. The Corpus Christi track really doesn't exist. The Valley track could be brought back. There's talk that Valley, to keep up their simulcast, may run a 1 day meet, or others say a 5 day meet. It's just a sad situation. This isn't what the act intended. They're basically trying to be simulcast centers until they can be slot parlors or have other gambling interests. And their feeling is that by having this license, it's the first step towards another license. But they don't want to race. They view racing as an expensive obligation. They just want to be a simulcast center. And, you know, it's ironic. I mean, someplace, someone's got to run a greyhound race that people can wager on, or there will be no simulcast. But no one wants to be that host. And I've been in touch with people out of state that would like to come in and take over a track, but surprisingly, the Penn National, which owns Valley, has not been responsive to that. They're hoping to keep their simulcasts with little or no racing involved. The Corpus Christi track, I don't know the full nature of the deal. The track there is owned by a partnership headed by a beer distributor, Greg Lamantia, a very nice gentleman, who has the golf people managing the facility for him. I don't know what conversation he had with them before golf decided to end racing, but someone somewhere has to have racing going on in Texas in order for there to be simulcast. And I'll be intrigued to see how that happens. It's the commission has ignored a lot of the act, and they've ignored a lot of the rules on scheduling racing to give the tracks as much breathing room as possible. But they're all in a financial bind. The licensing fees are just sky high. The opportunity is diminishing. There's a regulatory structure that even if these tracks had an interest in innovation, there's a lot holding them back. Part of this was there was a pivot starting in 2011. Coming out of the recession, Texas needed general funds. And the commission had previously been funded by outs and breakage. And outs are those uncashed tickets, and breakage is those pennies in a wager that, you know, between, you know, you don't pay $2.45, you pay $2.40. So the breakage is that nickel, and the outs are the uncashed tickets. And that used to be a healthy stream of revenue for the Texas Racing Commission. And that was faded out through two legislative sessions, and they were forced to take to fund out of license fees and and fines, and that really put them in a bind. And but the tracks, it became very, very expensive to have a track license. So there's a bad political decision made, and no one has stepped up to come up with a plan to correct it. Horse racing did benefit the breeding program there because horse tack, the sales tax on horse tack now funds Texas bred for horses. But there's nothing like that for greyhounds.
Yeah. You don't need a saddle or a
reins for a greyhound. Well, if you gave us a share of dog food being sold, we'd be very happy with that. But that's not what happened. It was just for the horse people, and that was a payback for the horse people giving up the fight to bring the historical racing slot machines to the track. That was a bitter battle. There were a lot of bad blood over that litigation, and giving the sales tax allocation to the horse people for their breeding programs, that was sort of a make good by the government.
Yeah, you know, I just think sometimes it seems like the regulatory and the licensing and the taxation burden is just such that it almost makes it's just too much. It makes greyhound racing, no wonder it's having such a hard time. And then you put the public image problems on top of that. It's a wonder it survived as long as it has. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think I thought they were kidding me at first when they talked about where you could have a greyhound track, and then I realized that they weren't kidding. When Texas created the Racing Act, they decided that there could be three greyhound facilities, and they said that they can be in counties of a certain population number, which had a barrier island. And so there are four counties that qualified with the barrier island and the population that hosts the three tracks. I'm still trying to figure out the correlation between a barrier island and greyhound racing, but that's where we are in the law. And so the Gulf Coast, the Gulf Greyhound Park, people say it's Houston, but it's actually Lamarck, which is in Galveston County, a county with a barrier island. And that's why they're there. And I think Greyhound racing, the future of Greyhound racing is more, to me, decentralized. It's more smaller scale, a more engaged scale, where people that own the dogs are much more involved with the process of racing, that are, they're closer to their animals. They're, I find it, you know, that the sport needs to change. And my fear is this legacy of bad laws and overwrought regulation will be around when the sport does collapse and no one will be able to come back and re-energize the sport and bring it back. I think there could be, coursing at a pro level. I wonder why there, you know, we don't combine coursing with Renaissance festivals and have engaged the public that way and create a demand for the breed and encourage the breeders. The breeders are going to have to become less industrial, more retail, but there's opportunity. And but I'm afraid, my fear is the this really onerous structure that's sinking the sport will be there and prevent people from reinventing it.
Well, gaze into your crystal ball for me a little bit and tell me what do you think the next few years holds for American Greyhound racing? What do you see the pathway being?
I see it, my best hope is that we recognize that there is no need for the regulation we have, that it is the detailed requirements on reporting these small wagers is incredible versus right now we have fantasy sports wagering, which pari-mutuel wagering in total volume, and it is a Wild West. There is no regulation there. And I think that if we could have a sport where people could go and watch a variety of races, from straight racing to coursing, and in fact have, you know, fixed wagers, like you buy your ticket and you end up cheering for the races that are printed. You the winners have been selected for you. You go ahead and cheer them on because people have not. They don't study the sport like they used to. They want to be entertained, and the sport has to tighten up. You can't, it shouldn't be a 5 or 6 hour event. It should be like going to the movies. It should be entertaining. It should be faster paced. And the dogs, our Greyhounds need to be a part of the sport, you know, and instead of being in the jenny pit, it's like they need to be where people can see them, and the people, the race facilities. You know, you go to Gulf Greyhound Park, and it makes me think of an Eastern European airport terminal. You know, it was built on the wrong side of the wall, and it's a dark, huge place, and it's not the future. A place like Daytona, which is a small, comfortable place with picnic tables out near the track, where you're right there watching the dogs go by. The people are it's inviting. It needs to be like that. And again, originally the NGA was coursing, was in the name. I think coursing needs to be a bigger factor, and there's no reason we can't bring, you know, wagering in some form to that, make it more entertaining, bring more people in. There's so much that, you know, we're in. All you have to do is look at social media. We are in the golden age of dogs. Dogs have never had it better than they have it right now. And yet Greyhound racing is dying. And there's no media engagement. All the great photography, all the great camera work, none of that is available in U.S. Greyhound racing. And so I would say that my partners in Go Pups, Eric Colson and Mick Ryan, we've been looking at investing our money and time in outside the U.S. in Greyhound racing.
Where? What countries?
Well, probably Australia, but it's not a very welcoming situation yet. We have connections in Ireland. We still haven't figured out how that can work, but we may. But Australia has come back from dark days in racing, and they have a commitment to improve the quality of life for the hounds for the people that train the hounds that I think is interesting. But it's a very tight circle of people. They're at one level, they're very friendly to us. But when it comes to actually trying to work with us on something, it's been a challenge. And we haven't gotten to we don't have a specific deal yet, but we're talking to people there. But Australia or Ireland would be the choices. New Zealand's a possibility, but mainly we're hopeful that something can happen in Australia.
Yeah, you know, that in all those other countries, it seems to me that while, yes, gambling, wagering is still the economic engine, they seem to have emphasized the sport aspect of it over there in those countries more than here. People seem to be more interested in the dogs. You seem to have more small owners who own one or two dogs. You know, they have the national races where you have the sports heroes that are the everybody knows the name of that's interested in greyhound racing. We haven't seemed to have had that here.
Well, there's certainly in Australia the track is a facility. It's leased. The association of the owners control the racing. They license the gaming. They deal with the sponsorships. The owners of the greyhounds are far closer to control of their destiny. It's down to them and the politicians. Nowhere is it ideal, but they don't have the component of the institutional track, which is trying to squeeze the most money out of a situation without investing more money in the situation. We have such an anti-competitive environment due to the regulatory structure. You know, we license people to be a winner by giving them a track license, and then when things change and they don't adopt it, they're not capable of responding to how the times have changed. I would just say it was when I first got to Texas to go to school at SMU, and I left Washington, D.C., where it was a real treat to get lucky and get a ticket to go to a Redskin game. And I got down here, and the Redskins were coming to play the Cowboys at the Cotton Bowl, and someone said, "You want to go?" And I said, "Well, how do we get a ticket?" And he said, "You buy them at the game." And I went to the game and paid $1 to park, paid $1 to get in, $1 for a beer, and it was a great experience. And now, if you want to go to the Cowboys, you can spend $25 to park, and you can spend $30 to stand just outside the stadium and watch the game on the big screen there. So for $55, and you go look at what's happened, you know, in this time between where pro football was and where pro football is, versus you go to someone who back in that time went to Palm Beach Kennel Club and watched a race, and you send them back to Palm Beach Kennel Club to watch a race today, and all they look around and see how everything's the same, and they go, but where's the crowd? That's the only difference.
Yeah.
And that's just sad.
Yeah, it really is. And it's sad for the breed. It's sad for everybody involved in greyhounds. Adopters, there's fewer greyhounds here in the U.S. to adopt, and that's going to get even worse shortly. Where do you see it going? Do you think it'll just go down to ground zero, so to speak, and then somebody will have to build it back up?
I'm hoping that we can find a business model that avoids the regulatory and economic structure. I think our hope is in the world of fantasy sports, of being able to, if for example, you're betting on, if you can avoid the Wire Act and if you can avoid the regulatory structures of the states and put it into a wager, like where people are wagering on someone's batting average or how the teams are doing in some performance category, and comparing that, your wager is two different performance categories – in two different games and not a heads up wager. You can be in the world of fantasy sports and be away from regulation. It comes down to, but you can't do pari-mutuel wagering. So then it becomes, who's going to take a chance on this? Who's going to see the entertainment value of our dogs going at 45 miles an hour at peak performance, of seeing that excitement? It's going to take imagination. It's going to take someone willing to say, let's do this in a way that doesn't fall within the traditional concepts of regulation. I think that's the future of the U.S. And whether it's going to a Renaissance fair, buying a ticket, and you've got the number two dog in a certain series of trip coursing events, and you might win some money, over your ticket, something like that, that it catches people to come and race and cheer on the dog. I don't see the future with the kids coming up today. How many can actually read a tote board now?
Yeah.
Not to criticize the schools, but I think there's a certain math skill that I think of that great American educational philosopher, David Lee Roth, with his, have you seen juniors' grades? I don't think that the people now going to the track, it really is a sport for old timers, and it's an old structure. And we've got to do something that's very different for the hounds to have a future.
What do you think will happen after Southland ceases live racing? Is there going to be enough infrastructure for breeders and finishers and so forth to be able to maintain a business with, two or three tracks running?
No, I don't see anything like that, because we will, after Southland, it will be down to three tracks unless something, there's a possibility that some Florida interests might get together to revitalize a victory land in Alabama or something like that. But we're after Southland closes, we're going to be down to just a handful of racing opportunities, and certainly not to support the structure that we have now. I don't see how the National Greyhound Association can scale to deal with that. I don't think the meets, what the last auction, what there are fewer than 100 hounds sold, 80 something, I believe, sold at auction. And that would be, there were times where the auction ran 3 days, and between the broods and the pups, you could sell 600 or 700 dogs at auction. And now we're down to fewer than 100.
Yeah.
And that's been during the time I've been in the sport. And those that were sold, there was only one buyer of a hound that was sold for more than $10,000 that wasn't connected to a current track kennel, and that was my friend Mike Freno, and he actually has a partnership with a track kennel for that hound he bought. So basically, the only people left buying are the handful of track kennels that have a estimation of that they're going to be in business. The individual, like my Go Pups partnership, we're out of it. It just can't work for us. No track is going to bring us. They're going to buy their own dogs. And like part of what happened with Southland, when they announced the phase out, the bottom performing kennels would be replaced, but they've locked in for the duration all those who were there. So they're all reasonably assured of being able to make money. So why share money by bringing in someone else's dogs? They're going to be buying their own greyhounds.
Yeah.
And it's just a sad ending. And when they amended the ballot question 4 to allow them to decouple racing, I said that was it, and people doubted me, and then it happened, and I hate being right about that, but that's where we headed.
What about United Greyhound Racing? Where is it going? Where do you see it going? You think it'll become international?
Yeah, United Greyhound Racing, right now, we are just keeping our top 25. If we can join with somebody that is going to try to do something different and perhaps try to do non-pari-mutuel racing, something about performance pay where wagering is tied in a lawful manner to other events or other statistics. If we can find a way to be in the new racing, we're going to be the first in line. But right now, we felt our time of banging our head against the wall is over.
Yeah. Well, I'm just glad that United Greyhound Racing will stay around. And if anybody's going to be innovative, it's going to take an organization like you all have to make that happen.
Well, Eric Colts has been – he's not only a creative marketing guy, but he's persistent. I mean, he just knocked on the doors. And I can figure a way out to make the paperwork work. And then we have others like Mick Ryan, who's, you know, Abilene. His whole family is Greyhound racing history in the U.S. And Ed Gardner was proud to be a sponsor. I mean, we have people that have been very committed to the sport and the United, the core members. We want the sport to go on. And right now, you know, our only public face other than putting Greyhound News on our Facebook page, and we invite people to visit United Greyhound Racing on Facebook. Our other activity is Mike Freno has the time and the people to put the top 25 together, and we'll keep doing that while we try to find an opportunity to make things better.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck. I think, you know, there's a lot to be learned from Greyhound racing in other countries. I've been saying that for a number of years, you know, they seem to have innovated and have done fairly well. They've had some downsizing themselves, mostly because of the land values of the tracks where they are. But you know, I think there's still some pages to be taken out of their books in terms of how to bring Greyhound racing back in the U.S.
The trick there for us to be, it would be great to and now. Australian Greyhound Racing is making a move to become to build a U.S. audience with their webcast and they're going to try to become more or build relationships with U.S. ADWs to make it easier to participate. But I think that for it to really work, we need to find a way provide a structure for U.S. People to have ownership interest in syndications in Australia, and we'll keep trying. But they are coming here with the entertainment. You'll be able to watch them. I think it'd be great if we could figure a way out for people to own those dogs or have an interest in them. And we'll keep working on that.
Yeah. Well, Laird, it's been a pleasure having you today. I think you've got some great ideas. I've always thought you had good ideas for innovation and that racing, especially here in the U.S., so sorely needs. Thanks for spending the hour with us, and we'll look forward to watching United Greyhound Racing on Facebook and then hearing about your Go Pups organization and their endeavors overseas.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm certainly, on behalf of the whole Greyhound world, grateful for what you're doing and the sacrifices you make for this to happen. And let's just hope we can work together to bring better days.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Laird Morgan.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe to Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. You can also write to us via the contact form on our website, greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. We're also on Facebook. Search for our Grey Nation Show page. You can also tweet at us. It's at Grey Nation Show on Twitter. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taras. Thanks also to this episode's guest, Laird Morgan of United Greyhound Racing. You can learn more about Laird and United Greyhound Racing on Facebook. Search for the United Greys page. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.